Call the meeting to order.
This is the Senate Committee on Oil and Gas. Present are Senators Pierce, Kraft, and Cotton. I suppose we're having a hearing today on Senate Bill 270. At least that subject matter is before us. For those of you who don't know, and I suspect everybody in this room does know, that this is a subject that we dealt with on a temporary basis last year. The law that passed last year due to sunset, I believe, July 1, 92. Is that correct? And if that were to happen, we would go back to the statutes as they were before we passed House Bill 196 last year. I think most people are interested in doing something other than allowing that sunset to take place. In addition to the temporary statute that we passed, Section 11 of House Bill 196, again, as most people know, called for the Citizens Oversight Council on Oil and Other Hazardous Substances to review the entire subject of response action contractor civil liability and the status of oil spill contingency plan holders. We, as a legislature, included money in the budget for that to happen, and the governor vetoed the money, but due to the resourcefulness of the council and the assistance from a lot of other parties, and that's very much appreciated, the council was able to complete their work, and that's primarily what's going to take place today as a summary of the report and findings of the council. We'll also attempt to hear from some other folks who are here today, the Marine Spill Response Corporation, and some citizen group testimony, primarily the Cook Inlet and Prince William Sound RAC Acts, or whatever the best acronym is this week. So unless other committee members have opening remarks, Senator Kraft, Senator Pierce, I'd invite Michelle Brown and Harry Bader, or actually Mr. Bader is the chairman, so why don't you join us and have whoever you like join you and give us your report.
Michelle will be joining me. I'd also like to take this opportunity to recognize we have another council member present, Leo Hannon, who's a member of the council, is also attending today. The other council members that wanted to, but because of our disparate places of residence, others weren't able to.
We are using the teleconference system, and there are people listening in, apparently in Soldotna, Anchorage, Juneau, and I'm not sure if there are other sites online.
Alyeska and Anchorage.
Alyeska.
A representation from Alyeska.
Okay, but I'm just talking about the different sites that are online. Right. Yeah, okay, thank you. Go ahead.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate the opportunity to explain our report. To introduce the report, first, I'd like to point out that we're going to take, to explain it, we're going to take a two-part approach. First, I'm going to defer to Michelle Brown, our executive director, who will give you the background and the historical development from the time of 196 up to present and the process by which we arrived at our recommendations. And then, with that introduction, I will then substantially go through the recommendations and explain the policy that we balanced in arriving at them and the evaluation criteria that we used and why we came up with them and what the advantages or disadvantages to the various provisions are. So with that, I'd like to defer now to Michelle Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Senators. As Senator Cotton pointed out, Section 11 of House Bill 196 asked the Council to report on the status of civil liability laws for oil spill response action contractors, and also to report whether the current state laws that authorize contingency plan holders to rely on response action contracts are adequate to prevent protect the public in the event of a spill. What our first task was to identify a list of research projects that needed to be looked at in order to analyze this question. We came up with a list of 10, and we provided those issues to many of the groups who participated in the discussion last year to make sure that we had covered all the bases. When that was done, we were about to undertake them when the fiscal note was vetoed. And so what we did is we went to these same groups, and they graciously offered assistance in providing that research material. Those were both the Prince William Sound and the Cook Inlet, RCACs, the Department of Environmental Conservation, Tesoro Alaska, Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, National Wildlife Federation. And each of those groups took up one or two of the research projects and then reported them back into the council. Although they participated in the research projects, the views that we express are solely our own, and these groups are not necessarily endorsing or not endorsing the final report that we prepared. After we got all of those research projects in and we performed a few of them ourselves, the council spent a considerable amount of time studying those various research projects. The issues are listed in Appendix A for you. In Appendix B is a summary of each one of those research reports. Mr. Chairman, you have a full text of each of those reports, and we have more copies for anyone who wants the full text, but we have provided you with a summary. We also received some rebuttal and supplemental information after we had distributed those reports out, and a list of those and some summaries of those is in Appendix C, and we have copies of any of those for people who want them. After all the reports were in, the council studied them, and then we set up some public meetings where we took comment, and there's a summary in Appendix F of all the comments we received. The council then analyzed the comments and the reports and had a public discussion of what their recommendations would be. Following the discussion, we prepared the report and the final recommendations for you. Any questions on the process?
Apparently not. Sounds good.
Okay. First, it's important to understand that what we tried to do is weigh what would be the best public policy, and there are a variety of concerns that are invoked in this type of policy evaluation. The overall objective that the Oversight Council kept in mind when looking at the limited liability and immunity process was what regulatory structure, as it relates to liability, would stimulate the most rapid and the most effective response to spills within the liability system. Therefore, we had to evaluate the current effectiveness of 196 and to assess what would happen in changed context and times and what improvements may be made to the system. Our position and ideas have therefore evolved over time, and there is, to a certain degree, marked departure from our initial recommendations last year on 196, and I will point those out when we get into it. First of all, it's important, though, to note that throughout this process, we constantly kept referring to what we identified as 7 evaluation criteria. First of all, we wanted to ensure that whatever regulatory or statutory system that we recommended, that it minimized interference with private choices and decisions on the part of private market participants and actors. The second was that whatever structure we arrived at would provide incentives for the maximum best effort on the part of individuals. Third, we wanted to ensure that whatever system we adopted or recommended, that it was adaptable to changing circumstances and to changing regions, recognizing that the transport of petroleum and crude in particular occurs in a variety of contexts throughout coastal Alaska. We also wanted to ensure, recognizing this, that whatever system, it was comprehensive and extended complete shoreline protection. Fifth, we wanted to ensure that we were as efficient as possible from an administrative standpoint, that administrative efficiency and cost effectiveness was very important. Sixth, we wanted to ensure that there was consistency in the standards and reliability. Seventh, in performance. And the last two are essential if we're going to rely on an essentially market-based or private initiative system for spill response, because where there is inconsistency or where standards are not able to be planned upon, and the vagaries of tort law make this particularly troublesome, you have an atmosphere where private actors may not be able to rely and therefore are chilled from entering into the area. Because we found that the unpredictable vagaries that are found in the common law of torts pose a serious threat to long-term protection due to this chilling effect, we proposed an immunity system that is conditioned upon certification. Now, we recognize that there has not been a problem up to this point of litigation in the common tort law against response action contractors. However, whether real or not, a perceived threat is just as chilling as any precedent. And therefore, if people perceive a threat exists, that is just assuredly a chilling effect which may prevent entry as if there had been a legal precedent holding responsibility. But we want to point out also that while limited immunity for simple negligence does induce entry into the market, it alone cannot ensure reliability. And therefore, certification is a necessary component. We are pleased in the last few days to find that certification procedures are currently under discussion by the U.S. Coast Guard and their task force and their rulemaking task force, and within four states that have adopted immunity standards. Where this departs from our prior recommendation is that we feel that the language that we proposed in 196 of substantial deviation is, because what constitutes substantial deviation is something that would have to be worked out through tort, essentially, that there was uncertainty, and that that uncertainty would again rear the head of a chilling effect. And so we have abandoned that substantial deviation language in lieu of a certification program which ensures professional standards, capability, and the ability of DEC to ensure that those who are listed on the C plan can indeed conform to the standards that they propose or are at least listed. I'd like to go through then and walk you through the recommendations as they occur in our report in the front. We found that the liability standards for oil spill response action contractors should be limited to gross negligence or intentional misconduct with certain conditions to ensure a reliable response. We feel that this limited liability will provide the inducement that I spoke of earlier and will rid us of the uncertainty that could be found in the common law. Now, the obvious benefit to this is that it is an active inducement. There is a downside to it, but we feel that the public policy balancing weighs in favor of limited immunity. The downside is equity in terms of assessing blame for those who cause damage. When you provide for this limited immunity, a response action contractor may indeed be negligent and cause damage. But because of the strict liability on the part of the spiller, we feel that the public policy balance favors this limited immunity, even though damage may be caused by a party who will not be held liable. That damage will be encompassed in the strict liability standards by the spiller. And certification provides certainty. It is a full disclosure document. This is recommendation number two, that professional response action contractors should be certified by the state. The certification is more than assurance by state government, but indeed is also the most administratively efficient form to ensure capability. What I mean by this is that only those response action contractors that are listed on a certification process can be listed on a C plan. Therefore, DEC is not put in the untenable position of having to track down whoever a contingency plan holder may list in their C plan to see if indeed that response action contractor has the capability, has the training, has the expertise, and has the personnel to actually carry out that which they say they will in the C plan. It is much more efficient to have a process whereby DEC upfront certifies these capabilities, has a listing. If one of those racks are listed on the C plan, DEC already knows the capability and whether or not that capability works with the capability listed on the C plan. So we don't have DEC having to run out after that trying to find these people. They're already found beforehand. The benefit to private industry of a certification program is that it is a full disclosure document. Industry, C plan holders, can rely on the certification process for an even playing field. They will not have to go out and try to independently verify the capability, the training, and personnel of the response action contractors. So in effect, the state certification program is a clearinghouse that will assist in a market-driven response action contractor process so that they can compete on capabilities, and C plan holders can use that information to verify which response action contractor possesses the capability that will most meet the unique circumstances for that region or that operation. It is necessary, this is on recommendation number 3, to recognize that a program should contain minimum professional standards for response action contractors and to direct DEC to establish criteria by which it can readily assess a response action contractor's capability to perform as stated in the contingency plan. It is essential that we provide professional standards within the certification process, because by providing limited immunity, we remove the social mechanism for determining what constitutes a professional standard. Because in tort law, we assess liability for negligence based upon what a reasonable person under those circumstances would have conducted themselves. This is, in effect, a professional standard. When we grant immunity, we have removed the public process, or actually litigation process, which provides that professional standard level. Therefore, we must fill the vacuum through DEC regulation in the certification program. Recommendation number 4, that certification program should authorize DEC to maximize coastal protection and to enhance regional response capabilities through response action contractor certification. This gets to the big picture approach, that DEC, in its certification process, must recognize that coordination to protect the full shoreline of Alaska is essential. We can't simply focus on a case-by-case basis, individual-by-individual basis, shipper by shipper, sea pine holder by sea pine holder. We must see how they interrelate, because to do otherwise would to allow for an area of risk to develop in less developed areas and our more remote and regional areas. And without that, we may find that bonding requirements may actually become astronomical for RACs in remote areas, Point Lay, Wainwright, this type of thing. We must provide protection for our rural areas. And to ensure that DEC takes a comprehensive view through the certification process is essential, because if they don't, I think through a variety of ways, either inaction or excessively high requirements or contractual terms, we may leave our rural communities at risk from getting petroleum, or having petroleum shipped near them anyway. Recommendation number 5. Certified response.
Harry, yes. Hold on a second. Senator Pearson.
Yes.
Thank you, Harry. On recommendation 4, I guess what I'm trying to do is figure out exactly how this would work and quite what the words mean. If the certification, if in having a certification program, DEC is supposed to maximize coastal protection, and they're certifying the ability of a contractor to respond, then is DEC going to be put in the position of saying to a particular contractor who has been hired by somebody, I don't know, by, unless you agree, let's say, the village of the city of Galena hires a response contractor. They've got fuel coming in and out, lots of fuel because of their military positioning, lots of fuel coming in and out, and they hire a response contractor to handle Galena. Okay, that contractor goes to a company, perhaps one of the village corporation decides to get into the response contractor business. So this village response contractor comes to DEC for certification. Does this language mean that DEC could say, well, that's great, and yes, you can probably do Galena, but we won't give you certification unless and until you agree to expand your sphere so that you can also respond upriver in Ruby and downriver in somewhere, whatever's downriver from Galena?
That's not what I envision this provision to mean. What I am most concerned about would be your example that, let's say, a shipper, whether it's Galena or Kotzebue, has a seaplane, enlists the capability, and I'm just using names for the sake of example, and not, there's been no analysis of this particular response action contractor, that they contract with VECO, because Vehicle has an impressive array of capabilities, that to be listed on the C-Plan for a C-Plan holder that is shipping in Kotzebue, they have to be able to demonstrate that they can get that impressive array of equipment and personnel to Kotzebue to respond quickly to meet the capability standards of the state. And so that simply certifying the capability to clean up so many gallons of crude per hour per vessel and so many vessels is insufficient, that there has to be a regional or local consideration as well. That's what I'm most concerned about.
Okay, so you're more certifying that the contractor can do the action in the specific place that the contingency plan
says they can.
Okay. That is
correct.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any other questions before proceeding to you? We believe that the certified response action contractor must be subject to all orders of the state on-scene coordinator during an actual or threatened spill release. This is important because the response action contractor and the C-Plan holder have a private contractual arrangement to which the state is not a party. Therefore, the failure, for example, to respond on the part of Iraq is held to the terms of the contract, and enforcement is a breach of contract action by the C-Plan holder against the response action contractor. And the state, without this provision, would have no way to ensure performance. For example, it is possible to perceive that it would be in the financial best interest of a response action contractor, perhaps, to break a contract and to be in breach, because it would cost more to respond than what they would get out because of whatever terms it turns out. Under that condition, without recommendation 5, the state would be powerless to enforce the response action contractor to live up to the terms of its agreement. That the state would have to go after the C-Plan holder, and that it would be up to the C-Plan holder to try to get the response action contractor to respond, or in the case that they don't, they have damages under breach of contract. But by that time, the damage to the local community due to the release of oil will have already occurred.
Well, at some point, whether you want to do it now or another point, I'd like you to further explore the motivations or some hypothetical situations where a response action contract would choose not to fulfill the terms of the contract.
I'd be happy to do that at this point.
Would you mind perhaps expanding on that thought a little bit right now?
All right. Let's say that we have a marginally capitalized shipper that has filed a valid financial responsibility statement. But the major assets are a vessel, and it's a single vessel shipper. The contract terms are that when the C-Plan holder becomes insolvent, at the moment of insolvency, the response action contractor is relieved from the terms of the contract. The vessel runs aground and breaks up. That was the shipper's assets. That shipper then becomes undercapitalized and, in effect, insolvent. The response action contractor, perhaps under terms of that agreement, is no longer obligated to respond because these are private contractual terms in which the state, in order to maximize private choice, does not interfere with. And we want to ensure that we don't, because we want contracts to represent the individual interests of the various parties. But on the public policy side, we cannot allow that to overweigh circumstances in which the state and the public will be left vulnerable. In that event, the state on-scene coordinator could direct the response action contractor to address the spill. Or, if we have a smaller spill in which the cost, because of whatever, the logistics, exceed the potential damages, they'll just say, we're in breach of contract, sue us for breach of contract, and the damage is you restore the aggrieved party to the position that they enjoyed prior to the contract. It may be cheaper for a response action contractor to do just that, depending upon the circumstances of the spill. We also want to ensure that the state can direct that response action contractor to respond and not suffer simply the cost of breach. So those are the two circumstances that motivated the council in providing recommendation number 5.
I think we're going to hear more about that at some point, but if there aren't any other questions, you can go ahead, Senator Pierce.
Why would a contractor sign, a response action contractor sign a contract with a company that wasn't going to be able to pay them?
Well, they could pay them as long as they're solvent.
But if the whole, I understand that, but if the whole point is you've only got one ship and that's your entire asset, I mean, these contracts aren't signed in a vacuum. I assume that if we know they've only got one ship as an asset, that surely the contractor knows that. And so I guess have we got some specifics out there that were brought to the council's attention that you're concerned about? Because I don't see a company getting itself in that situation. Response action contractor companies that we've got springing up all over the place, for the most part, are relatively sophisticated, and God knows they've got a bunch of attorneys.
Right. There is a specific example. There are contractual provisions, for example, that if a shipper violates a port information manual procedure or violates transportation routes, and that the violation of the route is the cause of the spill, that the response action contractor is relieved from responding to that spill if the spill was caused by a violation of either Coast Guard regulation or a port information manual. That is a classic example of where we would want to direct the response action contractor to continue to respond to the spill, even though, under the terms of its contract, it would have been relieved at the moment that the violation occurred.
I don't see how we can do that, but okay.
Well, I think it's just from a casual observer's point of view, there's a bit, you've described a major gap in the whole process here, and whether it's resolved by this recommendation or by another, I think it has to be resolved.
And I think it's important to point out at this point that is why these recommendations truly ought not to be perceived as 7 independent regulations, but are rather a cohesive, integrated system for certification and immunity. Because we want individuals to be able to draft contracts between C-plan holders and response action contractors to meet the particularities of their situation. We do not believe that the state alone can, with forethought, anticipate every condition that ought to be present. And so therefore, we want to maximize those choices, recognizing that also leaves a vulnerability. And so our intent was, by maximizing that private choice, we fix the vulnerability and therefore protect the public by recommendation number 5. In other words, our reliance on the contracting mechanism and immunity for inducement is flawed if we don't juxtapose it with recommendation number 5. And this does not pose an impairment of contracts problem because it is a condition precedent, or preceding, excuse me, to the contract. So therefore, it is a condition for contracting that we can legally impose without the impairment of contract provision.
Harry, it would seem to me, I agree that it sounds like there's a legitimate gap, but I guess the question that comes to my mind is, why are we approving this C plan if we know there's a gap in it? Why would DEC say, yes, you have an approved C plan if we know they don't have a response action contractor if the ship goes on the wrong side of a rock?
For a variety of reasons. One is that when we are in a condition of potential monopoly of response action contractors, that there is no alternative in certain regions of the state. And as a private actor, they set their conditions. It is potentially that if we do not approve these contracts, there may not be the shipment of oil. Now, we can fix it by having these provisions in there. Also, there's a certain degree of expertise. It is not administratively efficient to expect DEC to go over these very cumbersome, very complex, sometimes 60 to 100 page contracts for every C-plan holder to look at the minutia and detail of the contract law. It would almost, if we did go that route, we would almost have to open up a division of contract law in DEC and have a whole cadre of attorneys going through in detail every plan before it can be approved. And from an administrative efficiency standpoint, that would be far too costly in a public policy balance, and that it was more efficient to simply have a no-cost single provision that is preceding to any potential contract. It gets DEC out of the business of making passing legal judgment on provisions of contracts and trying to decide in various particularities, in various exigent circumstances, how the contract would be interpreted, potentially in a tort action. We're trying to get DEC out of that very cumbersome position.
Yeah, but it seems like we're taking the responsibility away from the owner and putting it on the contractor, and I think it ought to be on the owner, clearly. And so that's the philosophical thing.
Right.
That
is a concern. The problem is that sometimes the C-plan holder, again, only has one response action contractor in reality in which they can contract. And if they do not contract with that response action contractor, they do not have the ability to transport oil.
Go ahead, Michelle.
I think in answer to your question, Senator Pierce, this does not supplant the normal spill response. In a normal situation, the spiller will be taking control and directing. This is a failsafe. This is in the event that the contingency plan holder or the RAC does not comply with what the state had thought was going to happen in the C plan, but the state has an ability to quickly order a response to happen. So this is a failsafe. This does not supplant the normal structure.
Under our emergency, don't we have that authority anyway? Or I guess what we set up was a system whereby the state could come in a response if they didn't see it going right. So what we're saying instead, I guess, is that the state will just come in and command the contractor.
In some ways. I mean, what you could, in the former system, the state would take control of it, hire its own contractors, and respond. In this one, what we're saying is we have a system based on contingency plans. We've all drilled them, we've inspected, we've now relied on a response action contractor to implement that plan and given them freedom from worries about liability in doing that. So rather than have the state take over and try to conduct the response, let's just make this system on paper work the way it's supposed to, if it's not for some reason.
And then what's the liability that this on-scene coordinator is going to have for having said go do this, go do that, or don't do this, don't do that?
Whatever the tort law is imposed on it.
We're not taking the liability away from the state. We're putting it right on a single person rather than on whatever contract the state comes in and employs, it seems.
Well, that would be the situation under any circumstance. If an OSC order is going to be subject to whatever the tort law has developed on that, and this working discretionary decisions versus mandatory decisions, and in general, the state is going to be protected in those circumstances.
Well, we will be able to hear testimony from people who would represent the response action contractors on that subject, I'm sure. At some point, whether we get to all of those folks today or not, we will hear from them, obviously. In your deliberations, your offering to the public for a chance to testify, have any response action contractors commented on this subject?
Crowley commented.
I suppose the question that might be put to them is, can you envision a circumstance when you wouldn't respond?
Yes.
Sorry. And of course, they'll get their own chance to respond, but what did they tell you?
The response action contractor, Crowley, we did ask them that question, and indeed they said they can envision circumstances where, under their contractual terms, they would not respond. And Alyeska also was under the same, when asked directly, would you respond if one of your plan holder, I mean, we have one of the C-Plan holders who had contracted with you as a response action contractor, had violated a provision, would we be guaranteed that you would respond to protect Prince William Sound? And Alyeska at that time said they would be incapable of providing us with that guarantee. To a certain degree, we have a transcript from our conversation with Mr. Abbott. Quote, well, even if Alyeska made such a blanket declaration in which we obligated ourselves, there would be always the opportunity for us to unobligate ourselves at a future date. And as such, we'd never be able to provide you, I don't think, with the level of confidence necessary to preclude some other form of statutory guarantee. That provided us with a little bit of concern.
I think we share that concern. But again, in fairness, we'll wait to hear from Alyeska and other response action contractors on that subject. But I think it's obviously a very important point, and it'll be one of the focal points of this whole legislation. I can see that coming. Are there other questions on recommendation number five? You can continue then.
Okay. Recommendation number six, again, is a part of the whole and relates to number five, and that's certified response action contractors should respond when directed by the state on-scene coordinator to mystery or orphan spills, except that regional cooperatives will not be required to respond outside of their region of operation. Again, this is a situation in which if we do have a mystery spill, we cannot identify in the moments after the occurrence who is the responsible party. We can direct a certified response action contractor to respond to that mystery or orphan spill, and the state will guarantee reasonable recovery costs to that response action contractor. Again, this is a public policy balance that we have to protect ourselves, and that we can direct these response action contractors to respond to mystery or orphan spills if the state deems that that particular response action contractor best possesses the capability, the training, and the personnel to respond to the time, place, and manner in which the spill has occurred. And that we try to protect them with these guarantees, and eventually the state would like to go after the response act, the responsible party. But we want to ensure that this is not used as a disincentive of regional co-ops from building up. For example, if you have someone like Alaska Clean Seas, who has an incentive to maximize capital investment and response capability, there might be a disincentive to them to build up if they know the state could, in an exigent circumstance, direct them to respond outside of their region because they have such a great capability. We don't want that kind of disincentive to be rearing its head, and because it doesn't lead to reliable and quick and decisive responses. We want, for example, Alaska Clean Seas to build up their maximum capability without fear that it would then be diffused elsewhere because they have such spectacular capability. So we want to protect the regional co-ops so that they can be guaranteed that their built-up capability, that their training and their personnel will be on hand at all times to respond to a spill within their region. Because the worst-case scenario would be we have Alaska Clean Seas. Again, I'm just using these names for example. It's not we haven't talked to Alaska Clean Seas about this. That, let's say Alaska Clean Seas builds up a capability that is spectacular and splendid. There's a spill that occurs off in Kotzebue. We say, hey, respond, because you're a response action contractor and you're certified. And then a spill occurs within their region. What have we done to them? We've reduced their capability. That's not an incentive at all. That's a disincentive. So by protecting regional co-ops and assuring them that their capability will stay at home, we provided an incentive for maximum best effort on their part. Now, for-profit response action contracting businesses are not in that position. VECO has a capability, and pretty much there's no incentive for them to hold back in their capability. The better they are, the more competitive they become. And so we can direct them to go after a mystery spill because they're also guaranteed a reasonable recovery by the state, in the event that we can find who is the actual primary responsible party. That dovetails with list number five.
Would you repeat the caveat there? In the event that you could respond...
Well, no, we guarantee. The state guarantees.
Okay. Thank you.
There is no in event. I mean, otherwise, there'd be no incentive. I mean, we'd be...
I understand.
Yeah, no one would want to be a certified response action contractor under those circumstances. We have to provide that protection.
Thank you. We'll pick on Verka because I don't see him here today. Clean Seas. In the case of Verka, which is Alaska Clean Seas response action contractor, I mean, they have their own contractual arrangement. Verka's the one that comes up with the people. Mm-hmm. Clean Seas owns the equipment. Are we going to get ourselves in a catch-22 where Verka can't get certification because they don't own the equipment? They use someone else's equipment. In other words, if the state tried to say to a Verka, okay, you go respond to Kotzebue, they're certified, but it's not their equipment. So they would be, you know, you're in a situation where they can't take the Clean Seas equipment.
Right.
They could take their people.
And they can
call in equipment from other places. But you see what I'm saying? We want to make sure that we don't keep somebody from being able to get certification. And on the other hand, trying to direct them. We're almost back in the situation where it's our emergency system kicking in where we say, nobody else can do this, and we go out and choose a contractor.
That relates actually to recommendation number four in that's why when certifying, they have to be certifying the response action capabilities for a particular region in mind. And so that when they certify, that it would be these people are for this region, and that would get around that potential problem. It is a potential problem, and your point is very good in that it goes to demonstrate that all of these recommendations have to be thought of in relationship to the other recommendations, that we cannot dissect one recommendation from the rest and think of it in isolation. They all are interwoven to develop the public policy balance that the Oversight Council believes best achieves quick and decisive responses to spills. And recommendation number seven was particularly troublesome for the Oversight Council. That is that the Trans-Alaska Pipeline System agent should clearly maintain the duty to control and remove oil pollution within state boundaries related to the transport of Taft's crude. We need to clarify that. That is within state boundaries in Prince William Sound. We don't want the idea that if for some reason there is a spill in state boundaries related to Taft's crude in southeast Alaska, that we would hold the right-of-way holder or the TAPS agent to respond. This caused us considerable angst in the process of developing a policy because we began our approach that all response action contractors are similarly situated and that they should be treated when it comes to obligations and immunity and certification the same. But it became clear that when we applied our analyses to Prince William Sound, that mode of thinking began to fail. The salient point being that Alyeska is not similarly situated, both in the nature of its business, in its operational context to Prince William Sound, and in the perception by the general public. Those differences is that Alyeska is organized around its own activities for oil transport. It is not organized for the purpose of response action. It is a contingency plan holder. It is a potential spiller. Unlike other cooperatives or other arrangements, such as CISPRI, it does not possess public members. Mayor Gilman, for example, is a member of CISPRI, or Kenai, I should say. Management on organizations like CISPRI is conducted by a membership vote, in which the members are the shippers. That is not the case with Alyeska. CISPRI's members are its shippers and its member votes. Alyeska can act unilaterally as an entity. The response action capability of Alyeska is reflected in the capital investment, is reflected in part through the tariffs and therefore paid to the tune of 25% by the public of the state. This serves, in effect, 25% state subsidy. And that, as a result, shippers have already paid, in part, response action contractors who may not be members. For example, Tesoro is not a member of Alyeska, but it has already paid through the tariff, though it has no say as to how those expenses are used in spill prevention and response. And finally, unlike CISPRI, Alyeska prescribes how tankers operate within Prince William Sound through its port information manual. CISPRI does not have an analog to that. And finally, Alyeska is uniquely situated due to the Trans-Alaska Pipeline Authorization Act, Section 204B, and the right-of-way agreements that Alyeska possesses with the state and federal government, which is a duty to respond to spills. Now, Alyeska has commented, and correctly so, that in the Glacier Bay, Judge Holland pointed out that they were not liable under 204A of the Trans-Alaska Pipeline Authorization Act. However, liability for damages in 204B of that statute is not the same as the obligation to respond, which is encompassed in Section 204B. Now, given these uniquely situated circumstances, we have several problems that emanate. First, because they are private contractual terms, the terms of the agreement between the response action contractor and the shipper are unilateral on the part of Alyeska. This, in effect, creates an unequal bargaining position or near monopoly in which other response action contractors cannot enter the market. Because of the offset, in part, through the tariff, Alyeska makes no charge for its services as a response action contractor. It does, however, have a bonding requirement. VECO most undoubtedly would have to provide, if it was to provide a competitive response action capability to SERVs, would have to charge for its services. Obviously, if one contractor must charge for its services to be in an equal position of response and another does not, that contractor cannot enter the market. Also, because of its unilateral capability of setting conditions, they can set bonding requirements that can be disadvantageous to non-member shippers. The requirements, for example, of bonding of Tesoro could potentially drive a local business from access to crude oil in Prince William Sound's Valdez Terminal. Another problem that we identified was the 72-hour transition. And for this, I would like to direct you to page 81 in your complete report, because it gets rather confusing. And even though I've gone through this, I, too, make mistakes in trying to interpret my own arrows back and forth. And so, Michelle, please, if you follow and make and see that I am leading everyone astray, please correct me. On page 81, we can go down to, and this is just for purposes of illustration, we are not passing judgment on a particular vessel, all right, that we identify. I want to make that clear. We're just, for the purposes of this discussion, identifying three-quarters of the way down on the chart the Thompson Pass. The vessel operator is Interocean Management Corporation. The vessel owner is Shipco. Now, Interocean Management is the sea plan holder as the vessel operator. It has a contractual arrangement with British Petroleum Oil Shipping Company, USA, as its response action agent. BP Oil Shipping Company, USA, so there's an arrow going from Interocean Management Corporation to British Petroleum Oil Shipping. Now there is a contractual obligation that BP Oil Shipping has with Alyeska. So there's this arrow now going back from BP Oil Shipping to Alyeska, in which during the first 72 hours, Alyeska, with all of its local expertise, with all of its equipment capability and all of its regional training will respond. Part of Alyeska's response action contracts is that there is a transition after the first 72 hours back to the C-plan holder. So the first 72-hour arrow goes from BP to Alyeska. The second arrow then jumps back from Alyeska to BP, Oil Shipping Company, after 72 hours. And though they have drills, and BP Oil Shipping has indeed conducted drills in Prince William Sound, they do not possess the expertise nor the certification that Alyeska has for that particular region. So now we have, because of the 72-hour transition period, which is unique to Alyeska's contracts, we have a jumping around of responsibility. Within 72 hours, massive shifts in capability, training, local knowledge, regional expertise, that is simply not realized in any other region of the state. Fourth, we are concerned about the enforcement terms of the contract because the response action contract, and this relates to recommendation number 5, that the terms of the response action contractor, the RAC answers to the C plan holder and not to the state. And finally, there is the issue of reliability. Will Alyeska be there in terms, despite violation of its terms? And I simply go back to the comment from Mr. Abbott that we could not be guaranteed. Also, the same question was posed on the preceding day to Mr. Woods, that no matter what the provisions of the contract, if a C-plan holder, which Alyeska had contracted with, had a spill, could we be guaranteed that Alyeska would respond? And Mr. Woods responded that that is difficult to tell because it's complex. The contracts are complex. The reticence of the attorneys for Alyeska to assure that they will respond under a contract brings us back to the need for certification and that how can we expect DEC, who is not even a contracting party, to interpret the terms of the individual contracts, and thus goes back to the certification requirement of the recommendation number 2. With that, I am complete with my presentation. If you have any questions, Michelle and I would be more than happy to answer anything that you may want clarified.
I'm still a little confused about recommendation number 7.
Okay.
Perhaps you could give us a recommendation for how the law ought to be changed to accommodate recommendation number 7. That might make a little more clear to the committee members here.
They should be held to the terms of the right-of-way agreement.
So does that if that's
explicitly in statute. You see, Alyeska would argue, and have argued, there's a bit of history here, and I apologize. And please, Michelle, correct me if I go astray on reiterating the history, is that Alyeska, prior to the Exxon Valdez oil spill, conducted itself in a manner that interpreted the TAPA Section 204B and the state and federal right-of-way agreements that as the right-of-way holder, it was responsible for any oil spill occurring within the territorial sea of Alaska that was a consequence of its activities as the right-of-way holder. And pursuant to that interpretation from the operation, from the initial operation of the pipeline and terminal facility, up to the event of the Exxon Valdez, Alyeska submitted for approval to the state contingency plans obligating it to respond pursuant to that interpretation, that they were indeed responsible for spills occurring in Prince William Sound due to its activities. In the wake of the Exxon Valdez and after the termination of the emergency order, Alyeska then asserted that indeed this is no longer the case and that they are a voluntary response action contractor and that indeed, even though that they submitted C plans obligating themselves in the first 10 years of operation, that that was not necessary nor legally required. Our position is that this is a justiciable issue. It needs to be clarified in statute that the terms of the agreement do indeed obligate Alyeska to respond as they did for the 10 years prior to the spill. So it's not, basically, this recommendation is no departure from the status quo as it existed between the beginning of operations of the terminal Valdez up to the moment of the Exxon Valdez oil spill. It would be a ratification of that 10-year precedent.
I guess the obvious first questions are, what does our Department of Law and Department of Environmental Conservation say about that? Do they agree that that's the intent of the Right-of-Way Act and the previous legislation? Have they been involved in a discussion on this with you?
We have a report from DEC that does not speak to this particular issue, but does indicate that Alyeska is indeed not similarly situated with other response action contractors, whether private business or cooperatives. Like I said, this is an issue that was addressed by a contract that we led with Mr. Frank, and also commented upon by contracts led with Mr. Mertz, both formerly the Department of Law, and Deborah Vogt. So it was referred to in the contract that we received. We did not receive, and I think this is correct, a specific comment from the Department of Law on this issue. We have not.
It is a subject of the state and the federal government's litigation against Alyeska post Exxon Valdez, but of course there's been no decision on that issue. But it is consistent with the state's position in that litigation.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, I think that makes a pretty clear statement. Well, that gets you through your recommendations. I'm not sure what else you want to cover right at this point. I know there's a lot of material in here, but we've still got almost another hour left, and there are some people, other people that wanted to testify today, but I'd leave the floor open to you at this time if you wanted to conclude or make other remarks or summarize other parts of the report.
Well, just in summary, that this report is from the council of trying to come up with a comprehensive system. However, it is not complete, obviously. There are other factors. The council has always recognized that the state's efforts, for example, on compacting for a regional level is an important pursuit, but it does not speak to liability. So, of course, the focus of this particular report did not concentrate on that effort that the state is engaged in negotiating with other states, but that we recognize that we will soon be coming out with other reports that deal with implementation, for example, of 567's regulations and dealing with the compact negotiations as an example of the comprehensive scheme that is necessary to ensure the protection of Alaska's public from the damages of oil spills. And that's pretty much the concluding remarks. Michelle, you have anything to add?
No, just that the full text of the report is a detailed analysis behind each of the recommendations. So if you need, there's more information in the heart of the report. The recommendations is the short course.
Right, I've read through the rest of the report. I think I'm going to have to read it two or three more times before I can say I fully understand everything, but I think it's an outstanding job, and we appreciate, again, the fact that you've been able to continue and produce a report and despite the fact that your budget got cut severely, so thanks.
Well, thank you very much, sir.
Anything else that could be in there? Okay, let's see, where's the agenda? There's some folks here, Mr. Stephen Duca and David Lakin from the Marine Spill Response Corporation. We'd invite you gentlemen to join us at this time and make whatever comments you think are appropriate. might want to first describe who the Marine Spill Response Corporation is, so we can understand from what perspective your views are coming from.
Yes, sir. Marine Spill Response Corporation is a national not-for-profit corporation that was established in the wake of the Exxon Valdez accident by the industry to specifically deal with catastrophic oil spills, the largest of the large spills that occur. I'm here today representing the corporation because our president, Jack Costello, is our chief negotiator in the federal negotiated rulemaking process. And we have, MSRC has been discussing responder immunity with the state of Alaska for some time, here before the Parker Commission in late part of 1989. We had an opportunity to talk with many interest groups and ADAC back in September of last year, and indeed they knew that we would be, or that you would be handling legislation 196 because of its sunset provisions, and asked if we would not be available to come up and provide you with our perspective and information on this particular aspect of oil spill response. And of course, we are delighted to do that. We have been working with Shell and Dr. Bader and reviewing the Citizens Oversight Council report, providing them with information. So we've been with this particular issue for some time, and as I have listened to the testimony this morning, I think one of the things that I was most struck with was the need, as you consider new legislation, the need to very carefully consider what's going on in the federal process, because what is happening in the federal jurisdiction, just 3 miles off the coast, is a very, very comprehensive process that deals with, I think, with many of the concerns and legitimate concerns that Alaskans should have. You certainly have a perspective on oil spills that others don't have. The issue of responder immunity has to be kept in the focus of what is trying to be accomplished. And that is a bold and a vigorous and a sustained response to the oil spill. Everybody's interest is in getting the oil out of the water as quickly and effectively and efficiently as possible. That's the principal aim of the immunity. And if people lose sight of that, it's very easy to get involved with issues that are essentially extraneous to why the federal government, in providing a national standard, saw fit to provide responders with a limited immunity. And I want to stress that this is a limited immunity. It is not all-encompassing. There are many instances where the responder will be in a courthouse, be it a federal courthouse or a state courthouse. And I'll try to give you a feel for the limitations on the immunity. There's something else at work in terms of the federal regime that has been created. And running through OPA 90 is a principle. It's really a dynamo, a public policy dynamo, that the polluter will pay. Responsibility for cleanup is riveted to the polluter. He is absolutely liable. And if he doesn't obey the orders that are given to him, whatever slight protection he has in terms of a new and rather high limit of liability that he has to provide financial guarantees for, is removed. Moreover, If he doesn't act and obey the orders of the federal on-scene coordinator, not only is his immunity revoked, but he starts to incur rather serious penalties, monetary penalties. And this is all part of, a mechanism that is in place right now because it's the federal law. What is this responder immunity, and why do we think that it's important for Alaska to legislate a law at least as protective as the OPA 90? The immunity is provided to anybody that responds, irrespective of who pays you or how you're paid or if you're paid at all. If you are a responder, you receive immunity if certain conditions are met. And of course, that's in keeping with the purpose of the immunity, and that is to get all of the resources, public and private and volunteer, mobilized and willing and ready to act in an emergency. Not all acts, of course, receive the immunity. Only acts that are consistent with the National Contingency Plan or at the direction of the Federal On-Scene Coordinator, and in model legislation that we will leave with you, Mr. Chairman, for your consideration, with the orders of the State On-Scene Coordinator. Those are the only acts that receive immunity. You'll note that there's no mention of the immunity being being passed by a contract. There's no way to write those kind of contracts. They're much too complex and a large spill. Think of 11,000 people at work in Prince William Sound and beyond. And every act that they might perform being subject to a court deciding whether that act was either in accordance with a contract or in accordance with, quote, recognized approved standards. It is absolutely unworkable. The responders would be in court forever, and that has a decidedly chilling effect on not only initial response, but the sustaining of that response. Very subtly, what also happens is responsibility for cleanup is now being shifted from the polluter to the responder. We don't think that's good public policy. OPA 90's provisions do not pertain to either acts for CERCLA or the responsible party. He can't get any immunity. There is no immunity for acts which cause personal injury or wrongful death. If they occur even on a simple negligence basis, we're in the court. Responders are in the courthouse. Importantly, to rivet responsibility back to the spiller, any immunity that is received by a responder, any limit to liability, is automatically picked up by the responsible party. Therefore, there is, I hate to use absolutes, but there is really no incentive for him to delay response or to take what is the first normal action in a case like this, and that is to look for where I can deflect responsibility, i.e. liability. We think that's a good standard. It exists right now, 3 miles off the coast. 19 states have adopted it. We have talked to legislators like yourself in 19 states. We have talked to oil spill commissions, about a half a dozen. Three national legislative organizations have adopted this for states to consider in a favorable or positive way. And I can tell you that we have been run through a knothole that's pretty small. Trial lawyers have been looking at the thing very, very carefully, as you might expect. Environmental groups, we've had environmental groups testify on behalf of this standard. We were just in Maryland last week, and the Chesapeake Bay Commission rather forcefully defended this standard as good public policy for Maryland that is considering the legislation right now. We really do think it's sound public policy. It does what needs to be done, and that is assure the people of this state and the other states that they are going to get a bold and vigorous and sustained response to emergency conditions. We have carefully reviewed the Oversight Council report. We are very impressed with the very difficult task that was assigned to them. This is not an easy issue. It's not all black and white. There are lots of good arguments on both sides of the issue, and they have done a very good job. I'm especially heartened by recommendation number one. That is the federal standard, the gross and willful standard. We think that's sound public policy. Importantly, in not recommending a time limit that now exists, the 15-day time limit, I think the Oversight Council, again, showed very good judgment in making that recommendation to this committee. We have had some difficulty with recommendations 2 through 6. I will not get into the specifics of those. Time is limited, and they are in rather expansive comments that I provided to the committee in writing. I'd be happy, of course, to respond to any specifics you might have. But I think, in summary, what I'd like to leave you with is we agree that there needs to be certification of capability. Absolutely so. Absolutely no disagreement on that. It is the how that is accomplished. And using a responder's immunity as a cudgel to beat him over the head with, that we principally don't agree with, but there are other reasons, and they're all spelled out in the materials that I have prepared in writing. Importantly, the state now has, I think, extremely good guarantees that what is written in a response plan will indeed be available to execute. There's a whole process, and this gets back to my original statement about urging you to look at OPA 90 and what it provides to the state in terms of process, due process. How closely the state is aligned in this process and a part of this process to plan for things and to run drills and to do all kinds of things like that to assure that what somebody writes in a plan, they're going to be there and execute. I mean, the federal government really got the message, and Alaska were the people who gave them that message. I think there's general agreement that there were parts of the execution of the spill at Valdez that were not to the liking of not only Alaskans, but the nation as a whole. Congress heard that. And they put a lot of protections into OPA 90. I urge you to look at that process. Talk with ADAC about those things before legislation is enacted. One thing comes to mind. Title 5 of OPA 90 establishes advisory councils. This is the kind of and it appeared to me to be the kind of certitude that the Oversight Committee was seeking to gain through another mechanism, because those people are on the ground. Their neighbors are working at Alyeska and in Cook Inlet. They know what's going on, and they provide advisory information to lots of people. So I guess the bottom line is there are lots of things going on inside of OPA 90 that I believe accomplish the very legitimate goal of certification. I have only one more point to make. I was struck by the marginal spiller scenario that was presented for your consideration. And the reason I was struck was because it lacked any explanation to you of the kind of safeguards that are involved in this federal statute, where that type of a scenario, in my judgment, is about three sigmas from reality. The state, first of all, has an immediate draw under the federal statute, $250,000 to do anything it wants immediately. Doesn't have to go for appropriations or whatnot. So the state can immediately act. If a spiller becomes insolvent for any reason, or he doesn't perform as directed by the federal on-scene coordinator, The federal on-scene coordinator has a $1 billion fund, per incident fund, standing behind him to order anything that he pleases.
What do you mean to order anything he pleases?
To direct the additional resources, additional response action contractors, anything that he wants.
You mean he can use the $1 billion to order up whatever equipment he wants, but
that's
he doesn't have the ability to order activity on the part of an existing contractor?
Yes and no. I mean, he can order, let's say that a spiller's liability cap is $250 million. And the spill is large enough where that $250 million cap is reached in terms of response costs. The $251st million dollar or whatever it is, plus $1, the spiller can say, I have reached my limit of liability and I am not going to do anymore. The federal government can come in immediately and say, okay, do this, 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 and I'm paying for it.
I understand that. I was thinking of something else, but go right ahead.
Again, I was struck by the lack of at least presenting the information to the committee on the kinds of safeguards that are there. Plans are approved by the federal government. You just can't come in and put a response plan in and people put holy water on it. The state is a party to that transaction in terms of a potential spiller for him to move his oil in the waters from 200 miles out into the coastline, he has to submit a response plan that is specifically addresses a worst-case spill, loss of all of the cargo in bad weather. He's got to identify all the resources on how he's going to do that, and that's approved by the Coast Guard. That concludes really the main issues that I wanted to bring before you, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Well, what you didn't respond to was the possibility that the response action contractor, for whatever reason, might break its contract with the plan holder. That seemed to be one of the points that was raised here that you didn't respond to. That seems to be a major point.
There, from our perspective, there would be no reason for a response action contractor to break a contract if he is going to be paid and he is protected from good faith errors, which is all this immunity does for property damage. He's got that going in. He has already agreed to do that going in under this liability scheme.
Well, that's the way these folks talk about it. It's a speculative fear that they're going to assume some liability, even though it's really never happened, but it's possible. And so there's that chilling effect, as you point out. And there's also the speculative fear that nobody's going to show up. And whether or not, you know, that's likely, that's one consideration, but is it possible that no one will show up? So far, it seems like the answer is yes, it's possible. Maybe for some, you know, far-fetched circumstances, but if it's still possible, then there's still a speculative fear that nobody's going to show up. So that's a consideration that I think we're concerned about. There's kind of two sides to it. There's a possibility that they'll assume liability that they don't really deserve or perhaps maybe not want to show up because they're afraid of that liability. So that's one set of circumstances. The other set of circumstances is, as I mentioned, the fear that no one's going to show.
We think that and it's not just we, and the federal government believes that everything taken in toto, what's going on, and the responsible party having to plan for his spill and identify the resources, that will be certified in some way, by the way. I mean, there's going to be a federal certification process. We just don't know what the specifics of that are going to be. We really think that the fears that somebody who is on scene is going to walk away is not a a palpable, not a palpable fear. We just don't see that happening. What we do see happening is if there is not the kind of limitation on immunity because of the very, very large judgments that are liable in a post-Valdez era, that without a protection from response cost and property damage, the quality of the response is going to suffer if there isn't this limitation on immunity. That's the point.
Well, yeah, I understand. I mean, I think there's more than one point, though, and again, we'll have some further discussions on this, but if committee would bear with me just a minute, I want to make sure I understand who the Marine Spill Response Corporation is.
Yes, sir.
And according to this report, you're a corporation that was established by the Marine Preservation Association. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
And the Marine Preservation Association is made up of members of the oil industry based upon, and they pay dues based upon the amount of oil that they ship.
Yes, sir.
And you're an industry group. You don't represent the federal government.
That's right.
Okay. I just want to make sure I understood that. And the creation was as in response to something in Open 90?
No, it was really the Exxon Valdez that created MSRC.
When you say the Exxon Valdez created it, that encouraged the industry to have this organization.
Yes, sir. They did a very comprehensive study on all aspects of the transportation of oil, and in terms of prevention and response and R&D. And what they found was the country was all over the country, not just in Alaska, but the lower 48, was not prepared to deal with a catastrophic spill. And they made the judgment that it was their responsibility as the shippers of oil to create a capability to deal with catastrophic spills, large spills, persistent oil in the offshore environment, because there was nothing there to handle that kind of a spill if it occurred off of California or Oregon or in Louisiana.
What about Alaska?
Alaska, we believe, has the capability to deal with the catastrophic spill now.
So that's the reason that the MSRC doesn't feel that their presence is needed in Alaska.
Yes, sir. I mean, we carefully looked at the capability that exists around the country and the oil transportation pattern, and due in no small measure to the efforts of the administration and the legislature, there is a capability now in particularly in Prince William Sound that is larger than one of the five regional response centers that MSRC is creating. It really is. It's a remarkable capability you have. Absolutely remarkable.
So in your opinion, there are no gaps in Alaska as far as response capability?
I would not make that categorical statement. In terms of the catastrophic spill,
let's say there's no gaps in that category in Alaska.
That would be my opinion, yes, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Was MSRC organized primarily to deal with crude spills?
Yes, yes, persistent oil.
Okay. Is there any direct connection between MSRC or the Marine Preservation Association and the American Petroleum Institute?
No. Let me try to give you a little flavor for what we are and how the money goes and what's happening. Industry created two not-for-profit organizations. One is an operating arm. We're a 501c4. MSRC is a 501c4 not-for-profit. They created another 501c6, the Marine Preservation Association, as the funding mechanism for MSRC. We put in a request for grants of funds. Those funds are then taken from the dues that are collected from the members who need MSRC coverage and are transferred to us. There is absolutely no operational control of MSRC by MPA, and I think you can understand the good and sufficient reason for that. We are an independent, not-for-profit corporation. Lee Thomas is the chairman of our board. He's a former head of EPA. Jack Costello is a former three-star admiral who happened to command the Pacific area here. Is the president of our corporation. We have no stockholders. We are a public benefit corporation, specifically, exclusively created to deal with catastrophic oil spills.
Just on that quick point, is there, perhaps we already have this, but an organizational chart or a description of the corporate bylaws or just kind of a better understanding of the corporation would be helpful to me. Don't need to pursue it at this point, but if I could see the board of directors, how they get to be on the board of directors, that sort of thing would be of interest to me. So.
We'll provide that for the record. Be happy.
Thank you. Go ahead, Senators.
Thank you. I know we're off track in terms of the priority question we have in front of us, but I am interested in the MSRC. Who are the members, I guess, of the Preservation Association? Who pays the dues? Is it the, and I'm looking at this page of all of these vessel charters, the vessel, who owns the vessel, who operates the vessel, who has the seaplan, and all that stuff. Let's take the, go back to the Thompson Pass ship, for example, and the stream of folks involved with the ship, BP Oil Shipping, InterOcean Management Corporation, and SHPCO. Which of those, or are all of those, members, dues-paying members of the association?
I don't know off the top of my head. I don't know that any of those are. Let me tell you what I do know about MPA. Again, that's a separate corporation that has its own board of directors and its own president. The major funders of MPA are the household names in the oil industry. They are the BPs and the ARCOs and the Shells, etc. But they're not the only ones who are going to need to, we believe, submit response plans for this worst case.